A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And UnitedHealthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello, dear listener, and welcome to Owning It, the Anxiety Podcast with Caroline Foran. On this penultimate episode of this season, I am joined by Hannah Daly, an occupational therapist and author who I actually just worked with very recently in a private capacity to get my son's sensory profile assessed. Here, though, she helps me better understand the relationship between sensory issues and anxiety. So what comes first, the anxiety or the sensory issues? And is anxiety always a factor? Why do we have sensory issues? How do we know when we need to seek professional help? How does it differ from kids to adults? Are social anxiety and sensory issues inextricably linked? So whether you're a parent of a child with sensory difficulties or you're an adult experiencing anxiety as a result of sensory demands in today's world, this should be an informative and helpful episode. Thanks so much for listening, and as always, please consider joining me over on my Substack, carolineforan.substack.com/subscribe. Hannah Daly, occupational therapist, thank you so much for joining me on Owning It, the Anxiety Podcast. It's a pleasure to have you.
Thanks for having me, and it's great to be here today.
It never occurred to me to do an episode on this, I suppose, until it became obvious to me that my son was experiencing some sensory difficulties. And the more I went down that avenue of trying to support him, the more it became apparent this link between sensory issues or sensory difficulties and anxiety. So I really wanted to sit down with an expert such as yourself and explore this more and give it the attention it deserves. And when I shared on Instagram that I was going to do this episode, I was blown away by the people messaging me to say the amount of sensory things that cause them these spikes in anxiety. So it's obviously a very real, important topic. To start though, people hear, you know, phrases like OT, occupational therapist. Can you just give us a little bit of background on who you are and what an occupational therapist is and how you work with people?
I'm a mom of four. I'm also neurodiverse myself, and I'm an occupational therapist and an author. So in terms of occupational therapy, the way I explain it to people is that it's my job to kind of come in and support someone to understand what's going really well for them and what the challenges are. And then I kind of collaboratively work with the person or the family to come up with ways of overcoming those challenges in order for them to live the meaningful life they want to live. So it looks different in different settings. So as a pediatric OT, I might be concerned about play or a child being able to go to school or, you know, in social interaction or brush their teeth or, you know, get themselves dressed. So it's very, you know, different. And maybe in an adult population, it might be about employment, it might be about self-care, it might be about maintaining friendships, jobs, attending to a house and things. So it really fluctuates depending on who you're working with. But ultimately, the goal is to identify the issues, whether it's the environment or whether it's a challenge that the person themselves has, and find ways around making things more accessible to have a more meaningful life. So it's a funny one.
Can you just explain, I suppose, to give people more clarity, the way you would help someone versus maybe going like to a child psychologist or a play therapist or something like that? It's does it drill down more into the sensory?
It's a bit more practical. No, well, there is. So I suppose, first of all, you can train as an occupational therapist. And then if you want to train in sensory integration or as a sensory integration practitioner, generally it's OTs. Some physios can train in it and some OTs or speech therapists do too, but predominantly it's, you know, it's OTs, it's occupational therapists. We look at, we're more tangible, I suppose, than maybe psychology will take a different approach. So I might start by explaining all the different sensory systems, because I think a lot of people want to know, like, what is sensory? So we've got like the tactile system, which is touch, and that's the first kind of sensory system to develop, even like in uterus. So then we've got like auditory, which is like sounds and noises. We've got, you know, smell or olfactory, and, you know, taste or gastros. And you've got then, so they're the more obvious ones if people say, like, what are sensory? But then you've also got a thing called proprioception, which is understanding where our bodies and limbs are in space. Then you've got vestibular, which is deals with all like balance and movement. And then you've also got interoception, which is like hungry, full, pain, you know, needing to empty your bladder, bowel. So it's really complex when you actually think about sensory in that capacity, in all the different systems, kind of how they come together. For some people, it's kind of like, you know, the volume settings, like on a, or if you're editing something where there's loads of different things you can tweak. For some people, maybe the tactile, so the touch might be really high. So like they experience touch, like a tiny bit of touch, really intensely. And other people might have, like, you could be touching them and they just don't receive it. The message doesn't get sent back to the brain. So what's more probably useful is to, and you've rightly said so, that sometimes when people are stressed or anxious, they're going to experience some of those sensations even greater. But if you start with a level that's, let's say, not as regulated or not as evenly distributed, then it's going to be more challenging when you put stress in there too. And equally, they can trigger anxiety or stress if they're at different levels.
What you said there is interesting, and I think it's worth kind of going back to. It doesn't always mean an exacerbation of feeling. It can be a lack of input. So, you know, it would be a sensory issue if you're sensitive to smell and it's overwhelming. Like my son, it's funny, but I know it overwhelms him. But now we have a thing where, like, when he goes to the toilet, he runs out of the room until I've cleaned it and sprayed it, and only then will he come back in and we wash hands, and that's how he copes, and we allow that. And so smell to him, and for a long time we thought he didn't have a sense of smell because he'd never seemed to comment or notice it.
Yeah, so the person where you're not getting enough generally would be referred to as under-responsive.
Okay.
So you're under-responsive to different inputs. So it might be a child that is needing to touch everything. So funny enough, someone needing to touch everything, you might be saying like, oh my gosh, but they're actually doing it because they're not getting enough feedback from their environment. So they kind of, you know, and if they don't have enough feedback, they might use a different sense, like they might mouth things more because they're not getting enough information through the little receptors in their fingers. So absolutely, it can be issues. So if you take different, and someone can be over-responsive in one area and under-responsive in another. So like for me, I am under-responsive in vestibular. So it means I need lots of movement for me to register that where I am in space and kind of know where that sense of balance is. I need to move a lot, which means I'm under responsive to vestibular input, if you want to use the jargon. But then to tactile or auditory, so noise, I can't cope. Like if I go to hotels, I have to like do this massive thing before I go there. I like look up where their plant rooms are, have to see if there's any air conditioning, am I above a bar? Like I will just have to really nail it, because otherwise it's too stressful. I will have a massive meltdown if I go to an environment where there's noise, you know. So, and a lot of people will probably relate to that. And then obviously if you're going to a hotel or somewhere, there's more stress and anxiety because it's unknown. Yeah. There's a lot of pressure. There might be financial pressure. You might have had a childminder. So therefore you throw noise in and you just go, it just sets you off. So I would, as I said, be over responsive to auditory input. So yeah, I'm under responsive to vestibular. Okay. And you see a lot of that in different cases and different kids.
Let's take an example of something that you can explain or describe or define as a real sensory issue, like maybe the noise thing. And can you tell me or help me better understand, or maybe when you talk about the vestibular or the child touching things and needing that feedback, To someone who has never heard of this before, it sounds kind of beyond something that we could think about or, know cognitively. Oh, he just needs to the feedback. What is going on in the body and the mind, and what is the body looking for? And is it just looking to regulate?
They need to get more information about their environment. So if something is hot or cold, they might be for someone who squeezes things too tightly or has a very weak grasp. Like if the weak grasp, here's an apple, but a weak grasp might be kind of like this, and it's because they get too much information, for example. So having too much information can be a bad thing too. If you've too much tactile, it's like tactile defensiveness. You might not like tags, you might not like touching slimy things or dirty things or sand because you experience that as pain. And it can be quite uncomfortable, and it can be, so we it can affect you in that way. It's how you might want to hold your pencil. It might be quite a weak grip because you don't want to have that. Where the opposite, you have like this really tight grip because you're trying to get so much information. Or you might be, touching, over touching things, and it's just kind of if everything isn't balanced, if one is too, it can have. So sorry. For example, that can also have a social impact for a child or a person if they're touching everything or fidgeting, or but as well as having needing more information, it can be quite disconcerting.
So if the body is feeling that they're getting too much information or not enough information, is that something that a person is cognitively aware of?
As a child, obviously before I even knew about occupational therapy, what sensory stuff is, I said to my mum, like, I feel like the princess and the pea, where there's like all these mattresses and I can feel like the pain. And then like as a kid, I would have liked my siblings were out playing in the garden and I need to put my shoes and socks on. But the socks I thought had a right foot and a left foot. And if the seam touched off my toenails, I would literally lose it. I would strip all my clothes off and just fling my body on the floor. And I would say to my mom as like a 3-year-old, that's the wrong sock for the wrong foot, or it's scratchy, or it's not okay. So I think even as a child, these things that don't feel nice. As you said, like there's people I would say like, oh, that milk tastes like cow, like because I'd have a very strong taste. Or as you said, I don't like the smell of poo, or what's that smell? Like you say these things, and you say them because it upsets you, and you know it upsets you. But you don't know why it upsets you, as in you don't understand the science behind it. So a lot of times you think a child has been a bit fussy, maybe, or an adult might think like, okay, why do I not like going into that shop? It has a really strong cinnamon smell. I just can't, it makes me feel sick when I go into that shop. I've heard adults say these things to me, and they don't know why, but they know if they go into that shop, it's too much. They feel overwhelmed just by the smell. For that particular issue. And likewise, a person who has to sit still all day in the office, they might feel really kind of pent up and anxious. And that again is probably telling them something. They might need more vestibular input. Or busy environments where someone goes, oh, I feel like I've a headache, I can't focus, there's a lot going on. And they probably have heightened visual sensory system. I didn't talk about the visual one, too, obviously the visual as well.
It's so complex. Is it true that if you put yourself in an environment where you're triggered by those, your whatever your particular set of sensory challenges are, is your body going to experience anxiety, like your fight or flight mode triggered your nervous
You
system
get the fight
activated?
or flight. You either go, so exactly. So you can be over responsive to something or under responsive. So what you generally tend to see is either total shutdown, where like a person is like nearly numb, or you do the fight where it's like literally pacing or emotionally overwhelmed. Like I said, like you can become quite distressed by these sensations when you are in that state. Or you might see the opposite where it goes really high and then total shutdown afterwards. So you see a massive meltdown and then you see like numbness afterwards.
Because I suppose like the freeze is an element of fight or flight response as well, like fight, flight, freeze, fawn. So that is a stress response, is to kind of hold yourself still. And I also wanted to ask you about I would never have really thought that I had sensory issues myself. But what I really noticed was, and I've obviously the theme of this podcast is anxiety. I've experienced really difficult anxiety in my life. But when I was in a state of heightened anxiety, when my body was pumping cortisol, I would then get these. I was very aware of really disliking, like the noise on the TV felt threatening to me, bright lights, being somewhere. So that was almost the anxiety coming first and then making me more sensitive.
React. Yes. And that's kind of what I was saying. So if you start, if you're someone who starts with like a kind of heightened level of sensory stuff, so it's a little bit harder for you. You have to, so basically one of the issues is, I forgot to say this, you know, a person works really hard then to block out a lot of those sensations. So that takes a lot of energy as well, if that makes sense, because you're trying to block out some of these sensations. And by doing that, you get exhausted and your tolerance can, you know, as you said, can build. But if you're someone who, you know, because it's normal for everyone to experience sensory stuff at different stages. When someone is stressed, they will rock in their chair, they will chew their pen, you know, they might smoke cigarettes, they might do all these other little things that are telling us that they are, you know, trying to regulate themselves. And you know, the way you'd be like, oh, I just can't be quiet, I can't cope right now, you know, as you said, when you're in that state of arousal or stress. But if you have underlying sensory issues, it's like that all the time. So this summer I had really severe chronic migraines, so I'd already had the sensory issues anyway, but like I actually could not, like, lights, noise, everything, like I was like a mole, I just could not cope with any kind of, because it was intense pain. So it was just shoved it up a whole new level. So yes, even if you start off on these levels, you can shove it up, but equally we can do things to bring them down, and that's kind of the key. And we do them normally. So you were talking about you know, maybe if you're anxious and stuff, you might go for a run. A person might go for a run. They might have a hot bath. All of those provide us with different sensory kicks or hits, whatever you want to call it. So like immersion in the bath is, you know, it's got tactile, but it's also got proprioceptive. It's that nice heat, and it's got heat. So it's, you know, you've got running is vestibular. You've got proprioceptive if you're hitting the concrete. We do a lot of these things. Cold water immersion, which is one thing they talk about for use with anxiety, and they, you know, it's also sensory. Deep breath work, that is also, so it is all tied in, and people are doing some of these things naturally, and they might know why they make them feel good, but they do.
Do you think that people think that what they're doing with those activities is regulating their nervous system or bringing down their stress response, when maybe what they're also doing is giving themselves a sensory feedback that they might not know that they need? Or like when we talk about regulation, is it regulating the nervous system or is it regulating the senses, or is that one and the same?
Well, they are linked, yes. Right. You can, so if you look at sensory integration, if you're trained as a sensory integration practitioner, there is a theory that you use two sensory systems together to bring change, and you need to make it motivational, and it needs to be coming from the person to change the pathway, you know, to change how a person responds to those sensory inputs going forward when things are straight. But equally, then yes, the fight or flight response is what we're talking about, and that's why it's the emotional regulation, it's the tone and endurance, and it's being regulated, you know, it's all of those things that come together. It's just slightly a different approach to how it is, but also it's understanding that maybe, and seeing there's different levels within a person that make them more, you know, sensitive to environments with smelly candles for someone or sensitive to noisy environments or visual crowds, you know. So some of these things, and as well, like, you know, a lot of people who are autistic have sensory issues as well. And we know that there's a higher rate of anxiety and depression in maybe the autistic community too. So like there's lots of different reasons or circles, which comes first or how, which affects what, you know, is kind of hard to decipher sometimes. But
this is another head record, which was good. You're not going to like having to tease this apart, but there's very blurred lines to my mind between like social anxiety and sensory issues. Like if I look at my son, for example, when we were trying to start Montessori, and I've talked about this before in the podcast, and when we'd go out into the big, like to a lot of kids' minds, it would be just heaven, like a big open playground. There, you know, so much to do. And now I know that a lot of what my son was dealing with was probably noise, but also social anxiety. Like is social anxiety blamed when maybe it's the sensory thing of the noise and the people and the worry of being kind of packed in with people?
If you're anxious about noise and environments like that, you're going to be anxious about that. Yeah. But there's a reason you're anxious, because it's not in a nice sensation, you know. So you get some people that either like, so you can do something like ear defenders or something, for example, and that might reduce a person's anxiety to begin with, and also reduces the noise because they feel more confident that they can control it a little bit. So you're hitting it from both sides, but yes,
Okay.
it is. A child can feel, or I say a child, adults too, there's probably loads of us out there. A person can feel really overwhelmed and anxious about these things, for multiple reasons. Some of it could be the unknown, some of it as well as the peer interaction or the social component might make us feel a bit overwhelmed. And then you put noise and visual and people physically moving in your space, maybe you put a lot more sensory challenges in there. And what you end up with is like the perfect storm. And then it's hard to know whether it's the chicken or the egg. That's the biggest thing to start. But I always say, regulate the sensory system, give them the input they need, and then do graded exposure. And that's the best way to truly kind of figure it out what is what.
So say take someone, for example, bringing their child to a playground and they notice their child is not coping well. How would they go about teasing apart the whether it's the noise, whether it's the social? I've worked with you privately. I feel like there's an awful lot that I would not have known or been able to figure out myself. When do we, well, this is another question, but when do we know when to seek help? Like, what are the red flags? Or I feel like to know what strategies are effective, you kind of need to know what the issue is in the first place.
It is hard to kind of look at things, and the playground is a massive one because you've a load of different things. Some people struggle with understanding what they're able to do on the equipment. So they can feel overwhelmed as to, I don't know what to do with that. I don't know what to do with it. I don't know what to do with it. And once you show someone how to do it and break it down and make the task familiar, and they might have difficulties, what we would call initiating, so starting something. Once they start, they're fine. So that could be that. So there's no point in me saying, okay, dress them in blah 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 and do this, because if that's the issue, then you just need to gently expose, give them exposure to that, maybe hand over hand, maybe model, maybe place them, maybe do a social story if it's that component. If it's it could also be that the child has a thing called gravitational insecurity. So some people don't like, and that's a massive anxiety provoking one actually. They don't like when their feet are off the floor, or that sensation of when their head is back in the bat, or they feel really, they experience movement, like to say if they're over responsive to vestibular input, they feel movement is a little bit like you're on a boat kind of sensation, like if the things are much bigger than what they actually are, because their brain, the message that's being sent back to the brain, isn't thing. And it doesn't mean they need to avoid it. Actually, they need graded exposure, and they might need like linear movement. So linear is like swinging, and that's really calming and regulating. But sometimes you need to support a person by giving them proprioceptive, which is like the deep pressure, to enable them to be comfortable enough to get the linear, to then get enough of an input to get their hit, if that makes sense. Behavior is communication, but it's the little subtleties, and you can look at like, are they having a meltdown? Is it about control? Is it about this? So then the playground, it could be the noise. If it's noise, you kind of have a hypothesis, and then you check, you try it out. If you're a parent, okay. So, keep a journal and go, like, what happened before I gave him black, I gave him sugar, I gave him this. So it could be that component. What happened before he had a meltdown? Or no, he was happy until someone spun him around. So maybe he doesn't like rotational movement. Maybe it's a busy environment, it's noisy. It's like a lot, I'm sure like there's adults that say, I like doing weights, but I don't like going to the gym because it's too noisy and the smell and the noise, and the so bright. So it is really kind of figuring out. I'd say don't be afraid to be your own expert as well. Like, don't be afraid to kind of go, oh, do I like that or not like that? Why don't I like that? Be inquisitive about some of these sensations.
How do we know when we have a sensory issue or difficulty versus just something like that we don't like? Like, I don't like touching, I like stuff in the dishwasher. I just I'm like, bleh. I just don't want anything manky on my hands, but it doesn't cause me any great distress in my day-to-day life. Do we, I mean, I know as kids it's more important if it's really affecting their development or their social skills or things like that. But as adults, maybe, do we have to know if there's a sensory issue?
You know yourself, and the reason is back to that because you're spending expelling a lot of energy and stress trying to block sensations
Okay, so
out.
you could be exhausted.
You would be absolutely exhausted. And it's part of the exhaustion that you could argue leads to the meltdown as well.
Because then you're
Do you know
more
what I
vulnerable.
mean?
Yeah, it's just.
Yes. It's all kind of circular. And like sometimes the sensory thing can impact on sleep too. So, you know, or like a really simple one is interoception. If someone doesn't know when they need to wee or empty their bladder, it can be very dysregulating because you find people are holding then and then they're all very dysregulated. Or if they can't understand when they need to eat because they're not getting that hunger sensation, then, you know, their blood sugars might be going all over the place because they're not able to detect that.
Yeah.
You know, so
Yeah.
that is an issue. If they are issues for you, and it's not even an issue, you just need to, some of them you just need to be aware of, and some of them you need to, you not need to, you might want to increase your physical activity as an adult. You might want to, people get massages. That's also like working on the proprioception, you know, these things.
Thank you for the justification of why I'm going to get a massage every
But
month.
if it's self-care, it's self-care. Like I suppose things, you know, if it's a sea swim, if it's whatever, if it's what you need, then you need it. And that's okay. And like it, back to your question, if you're having massive meltdowns or if you're finding that you're avoiding a lot of things. So as an adult, what you probably find is that a person will avoid doing and going places, and then maybe stemming from a sensory thing. So maybe understanding it from that perspective would be useful because we, you know, they might not go to restaurants, they might miss out on birthday parties, they might miss out on social opportunities. So that isn't necessarily, well, if it's not an issue for that person, that's fine as well. And it's okay, like, are you okay with baking, like, or getting your hands, apart from manky stuff in the dishwasher, are you okay? So that might be more as well, the idea of, oh, this is disgusting because it's dirty and now I'm feeling it, you know, as opposed to a tactile issue as such.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive and June. Olive and June gives you everything that you need for a salon quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive and June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive and June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee, and you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love. And be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit eBay.com for terms.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
It's very clear to me when a child is melting down, but you mentioned yourself, you know, if you didn't have those boxes ticked before you went to a hotel, like you could have a meltdown yourself. What does a meltdown as an adult look like? Because I know in a different way, like a panic attack can look like nothing. Like so people would never, ever have known I was having one. It's so internal and I'm just like combusting from the inside out. What does it feel like or look like for you to have a meltdown?
Adults meltdowns. It's emotional response. It's needing the thing to be resolved. It could be hand over ears. It could be rocking. It could be can't cope, need to leave. It could be, do you know what I mean? Like it can just be too much, and the emotion, like probably similar to what you might see a child do, but it's I think in adults it's a lot less because we don't put ourselves in situations like you do all the preparatory work to it, but sometimes it just becomes too much and it is literally a person just feels overwhelmed, and it can affect your speech then because it's very hard to talk when everything's very dysregulated. You might experience like pain, you might experience kind of just, it's like someone, like you're being attacked by all the different sensory systems at the same time, and it just builds and it's too much. And then after that, it's shut down.
In terms of the how, you know, that kind of behavior or response would be perceived in society, like obviously, you know enough to know this is my sensory issue, that I need to have these certain things in place. For, I'd say there's so many people listening who are like, yes, I feel that way, but like my partner or my parent is like, just thinks I'm a control freak, or like I need to just relax and chill. And it must be so hard when it's not understood. And this to me sounds very misunderstood. And
well, I think when you say to someone, relax and chill, it's just going to heighten.
But, and people, I know, and people do it all the time.
What you need to do is say, okay, what do we need to... So if you're a parent or a partner and you have someone like this, I would say, I would ask them, what do you need from me? Do we need to just have a bit of a quiet space? What I would generally find helpful is going for a brisk, heavy walk, or, you know, if you know you're going into a stressful environment, regulate your sensory system before you go in. Do the proprietary work. Ring them. Pick. I pick tables in hotels or restaurants. I will say, and I will go and say, I want that one because it's not near a speaker. It's not in the middle of the room. You know, all of these different things to help make it a much more enjoyable experience. So,
and would society, or would you feel pressure that you need to try and not plan to the nth degree because the world won't always accommodate? And if you go into a situation where there is noise, do you feel that you need to have the exposure and the experience to be able to handle the unpredictability of life? Or do you feel like, no, if you know that these are the issues, go to the nth degree for yourself and try and control everything?
You can't control everything, but you reduce the things that are going to heighten you, that you know are going to cause you stress or distress. Or you do it and you know, I'm going to go there and afterwards I'm going to be absolutely wrecked and I'm going to whatever, you know, or, and they might be the times where, so again, if you're someone who's got tactile issue like me, you will wear your baggiest trousers. You will compensate in other ways, because when you have all these tight things on, you're ramping your nervous system up, your sensory system is finding, having to deal with a lot of input anyway. And then you go into all these other things. I mean, of course, you might then get food, and like if you're particular about smell or slime or taste or certain things, that control you too. So you've got like in every which way being thrown at you. And like, for example, people like me are not, there's loads of people out there who are like that. Like my husband is amazing. He really gets it. You know, he's in healthcare too. And he knows that actually it's worth ringing a hotel twice or three times and being like, my wife's neurodiverse, blah, blah, blah. And this is why it's important. There's an onus on the person not to exploit the thing that they have, and to understand what are their triggers and what they can cope with, and to decide if it's, you know, do a risk assessment nearly, if that makes sense. And I think I've gone in and done talks for like, you know, very large establishments that are disability friendly, and had to say, could you turn the light off, please? Because this is bright light sitting in front of you as you're about to do this massive presentation. And they kind of go, oh, really? I never thought of that. So I think lots of people feel that way, but you need to advocate and be able to understand that it's okay to say, like I had an office where I had a shared office and I just had the light bulb removed directly from above my desk.
Okay.
But it didn't affect anyone else, but enabled me to function better and not be consciously stressed and anxious. But I think if I don't say, can you turn the speaker down or can I sit here? I would be very, very anxious.
And so you really have to advocate for yourself.
Yeah, and you have to know what it is you need. And it's actually people, I found, it's easier to ask and be direct than to be like a big emotional wreck, and people don't know what to do. And then you feel, oh, odd or guilty or all these things. It's, that doesn't really help, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
But I think like it's great we're having this conversation today. Like if there's people listening that might be, you know, school and teachers or restaurant owners or whatever, that they might go cheaper, or hospital environments, like all of these things, they might go, okay, maybe we could change a few things and make it much easier for make everyone feel more relaxed.
Yeah, because one thing when we were trying Montessori, it was already, you know, bright. There was loads of kids, noisy, and then they turned music on as well, and I could just feel him shrinking more, and I was like, oh, he's just gonna have to cope. And he couldn't cope. Now obviously at the time he was just gone three, and I know we're working on to help him cope better. But something I wanted to ask you was about, I suppose, the function of it. I always like to tease apart and go back to, like, anxiety has a function. You know, our stress response is there to protect us from an evolutionary perspective. And I'm not sure if you can speak to this, but what is the point of, like, how can we have evolved to be overwhelmed by light and noise?
We now live in a society where it is constant. If you think when we grew up, like, you had your little radio, well, when I grew up, yeah. When you had like your little CD disc, like, it was very different in terms of there's constant screens, there's constant noises. Like, that thing that went off was a gift, a kid's toy that was like, oh, you know, there's way more noises, bright, like when we had kids, we had one light in the middle of the room, maybe. Now you've like 20 spotlights in different places. So I think the environment has become busier, faster and noisier as well. And maybe our response is saying, no, we need to calm it down. We need to get back to nature. We need to get back to playing, because kids aren't playing anymore. Kids are playing on computer games. They're not swinging and climbing, and that's impacting person's gross motor. Maybe we're not meant to be in as this kind of environment as much as, you know, we've lost touch with the roots of what makes us feel good when we feel stressed or anxious. It's generally calmer spaces. It's generally connection, which is touch, which is being close to people. It's swinging. It's the sea. It's, you know, all of these really healing things. And actually, maybe we're presenting more and more with these sensory issues and stuff because we've lost.
Yeah.
We're not priming ourselves in the correct, you know, we're not feeding what we need. And I think the world needs different people. And different things. And I think we all bring different things to the world, even with, you know, our challenges we have. And that's what OTs do. We look at the strengths of a person too. So you don't just say, oh, this is all wrong. It's like,
yeah,
you're more sensitive. You're a sensitive soul. You pick up on things, you know.
And that's great as well, in lots of ways.
You have great taste. You can taste like levels of flavors and, you know, cooking and stuff. Like, this is an amazing skill. But then equally, if you have less of something, it might also be a gift because, okay, so for example, I'm severely dyslexic. So reading and the written text is too much for me, but my memory and my, you know, hearing is phenomenal. So you compensate in other ways. So it makes life interesting, I would say.
Absolutely. I always think that when it comes to anxiety anyway, it's almost the level of anxiety that we all seem to carry these days is this side effect or hangover from the fact that we've evolved so much in society and culture, and, you know, with technology, we've leapfrogged so much further than we were ever ready for as humans. And so when you put us into these environments where there's all this input and all these, you know, stimuli and stress response, because I think people really need to understand, why am I feeling this way? And it's not that you're just broken or disordered or something like that. I think, like, when I was able to understand anxiety as I'm putting myself in situations that, because I'm sensitive, maybe I feel it more than the next person, but as a whole, we were never meant to be here this soon. Like, we're dealing with a brain that's quite primitive. And it's great that we've jumped ahead in loads of ways, but our bodies and our minds are still trying to catch up. And I think, from my understanding, that's why we run into a lot of difficulties, like jealousy, for example, feeling, oh, well, if she gets that means I can't have that. You know, the feeling of, because it goes back to hunter-gatherer times. So it helps me understand, to think of it from an evolutionary perspective of, you know, we're still playing catch up, which is why nature would not have had this many bright lights, or nature would not have had this much noise, or nature would not have had this many screens, you know?
Yeah. And it is. And I worry sometimes about generation of my kids and stuff.
Yeah.
You know, and obviously I'm working with pediatrics, like, it's like, this is the best thing. Like, even the birthday parties and stuff, they're these big noisy environments with like 100 kids and everything. No, we had like a little tea party the last day with like five or six little kids, and it was the best thing in the world. And there was connection, and do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
it's almost like, and like during the summer when I was having the migraines or whatever, I was like doing conscious connected breathing. I was having someone teach me how to do real deep slow breathing, and I'm thinking, this is crazy. Why are we paying for like air? Like, how have we got that far? And it is, we need to strip back. We need to kind of, and we need the time to pause. And when there's a lot of noise out there, we don't get to check in, and we don't get to like reflect and figure out what we're doing. So we get kind of dragged with the current, or whatever you want to call it. And my really nice about OT, a lot of the times it's like, it's back to the basics. It's sleep, it's exercise, it's, you know, it's all these simple things. And we're losing our skills as well. So like people say, why are like, there's lots of kids presenting, let's say they seem like they have motor coordination issues, but they don't actually meet the threshold, but their scores are quite low compared to previous generations. And that's because they're not swinging, they're not climbing, they're not playing with muck, they're not, you know, all of these other things. And then you throw in COVID in there too. And you had kids that never got any opportunity to even go to those big parties and climb, at least in a soft play area, you know, because of all of those other things. Then it's all going back. How many families have swings in their gardens these days? Very few. Our generation all had swings. And the swings actually is really important for a child, especially a child with sensory issues. It can be really important.
What happens when, for a child, for example, or even an adult, if a sensory issue that's quite interfering with their coping through the day, if that gets left unaddressed, like, if I hadn't have sought out the support that we're seeking for Kaylin, is it something that, are these issues something that you'll always have and you learn to manage, or do you grow out of it, or what happens if you don't?
No, like, first of all, you probably would just be like, okay, we need a different environment for our child. And you probably would have figured out what works. And without knowing the lingo or the terminology or why, you'd go, this is a better fit for my child. And we do that as parents all the time. We kind of, one child likes eating this or doing this and the opposite. You probably pick extracurricular activities maybe that are more individual, like swimming or running, as opposed to like GA or rugby, that's a bit more visually busy and, you know, different components too. So you'd find the things that would work. Absolutely, as he gets more used to certain things, some of those will probably dampen down a bit. And that's why, like, what a 0 to 3 year old will present more sensory. They might make things more. They do all of this stuff because their systems are developing. But if you have a child who, and they swing out of things, you know, they play with all those things. If you had a 10-year-old presenting like a, you know, a 3-year-old with objects and how they hold things, and, you know, it's all very primitive, then that's where the issue is. So some of those things will improve for a child if they don't have any input. And in others, you probably will see more behavioral issues potentially, so more meltdowns. And then you won't realize what's going on. You'll be like, God, this child is really fussy. Or, you know, I had a child that used to be like this. And then we do the sensory input. And then, sorry, he would be like rocking and touching everything and like, oh, I don't want to. And then we'd do the sensory input. And would, his attention was massive. He could sit and like apply, you know, attend, like millions of kids. I had like loads of kids I had like this in my case that would then be able to attend and play and do their homework. And people would say, I didn't know they could do that. I'm like, yeah, but you're helping them be able to see what's in front of them and to use the things, because otherwise like the shutters go down on different things and it's just doesn't work. And that's just like, and then sometimes like I can't always figure out if shoes fit me or not, because that kind of interceptor, so I'll have to get my husband to like touch the toes and, and tell me if it's a good fit. Now again, I'm lucky he's a physio, so he's good with like all that stuff, but I don't know myself. So you probably loads, and I'm sure loads of people are going, oh, you know, I always buy two sizes up. I always, you know, and that's a safety net. So you adapt. As humans, we do adapt. We're quite good at adapting, but whether it's serving us or not. So as I said, you might opt out of things. Is that serving? And that can have an impact on a person's self-esteem as well, if they're not doing things. And it's the chicken and egg. Is it depression because of this, or is it because of this? So it's definitely worth understanding what's going on for a person from as early, but equally don't let those labels stop a child having exposure to these things, you know?
Do you think it's helpful for everyone, or if people are curious, to have their sensory profile done, or like when should someone seek assessment? And that sounds kind of intimidating, but really for me, it's been with Kaylin, it's just been clarity so far. Should everyone be looking into this if they're having sensory difficulties?
I know, like I had sensory issues all through my life. Like I was known as the nudist, like and the fussy child, but that was just Hannah. I think, and like as I said, sensory overlaps with lots of things like ADHD and other kind of other things. So it's I think only if something is having a massive impact on your life. But I think what maybe more importantly than having your child assessed is if your child is doing things, have just accept a bit more acceptance, kind of go, that's them. They like that. If it's an issue, like if a child likes chewing things, as long as they're not chewing stuff that's dangerous or broken things or breaking things or socially unacceptable, then maybe is it a bad thing? Or maybe give them, I suppose the question is it worth getting assessed? And I'm trying to say, even if you are assessed, it just gives you more information,
It
but you
doesn't
may
change
not.
anything,
Well, it changes maybe how you approach things. So then I will often say, like, well, what do you think is the issue? The problem with some of the assessment forms, they only go up to certain ages. A lot of them are normed. So you can use it for older ages sometimes, but it's not going to be as sensitive. So you may not pick up things. There's a thing called a sensory integration and practice test, which is a SIPT. But again, the age I think goes up to, it's been a little while since I've done one, around 10, I think, or 10 or 12. And a child needs to be really good at kind of cooperating to do that assessment. And it's really expensive because it's hours and hours of clinical time, as well as the application, the forms are really expensive as well. So and the software that analyzes it. Yes, you could bring your child to see an occupational therapist and they can do observation and will ask you questions as well, which is sometimes more useful to kind of go, okay, well, they don't like noises, they don't like smells, they do like this, they don't like that. You can kind of almost know that about yourself. Like, for example, would you, apart from the touching of things, are you fine about noises or visual or movement or any of those like other things?
So I actually had a virus years ago after I had the flu, and it was vestibular neuritis. And ever
Yeah.
since then, I can't even go on a kid's swing. I feel so uncomfortable. So any kind of fairground rides, and it used to be like, oh, you're just such a scaredy cat. I'm like, my body just hates it. I don't like that. I feel unsafe. So that's been a new-ish issue for me, but one I can easily avoid. And then it's really only if I feel super anxious or I'm in a state of panic, which hasn't really been an issue, in the last few years, only then would I feel like this, the noise and the screens and brightness would affect me. But I very much know that that's the anxiety coming first for me.
Yeah, okay. So for someone like you, then there'd be no point in
No.
being assessed because you kind of know yourself, and that's kind of what I'm saying.
Are we at risk as well of just going down too many avenues of too much information? And I feel it's been amazing to understand more about my child and not just, be like, oh, he's odd or anything like that. I think we're going in such the right direction, but also, like, are we turning over stones that we never would have turned over, that we're, worrying about more than we need to worry about?
I think what, and it goes back to the thing, is looking at the solutions. So can we change things like the restaurants, like the hospital appointments, like the way we do stuff, like queuing for, we used to have to queue to go see, for example, Santa and Arnott's. You had to come at a certain time and you'd queue for hours if you wanted to see the Santa with the beard. You know what I mean? Then COVID happened and now you can book a ticket online at a set time and things. They get the same amount of input, but you don't have loads and loads of people standing around, not knowing, feeling overwhelmed. We can be smarter. We can use technology in a positive way to be smarter. The big issue like this is, well, you've got a misconception of sensory spaces, like, oh, this is a sensory room, and not understanding, well, what you're putting someone in a space, but what are they getting from that space?
And they might feel unsafe because they're not with you, or they're on their own, or it's not familiar to them.
Well, it's not giving them the proper sensory. They're not, putting someone in a room with lights and a bubble tube and like solid hardness. That's not going to change. Like that's a nice, it's a multi-sensory room and it's fine. But if you want to like help someone regulate or get the input they want and need. So when you do sensory integration approach, you try and change a person's tolerance to different sensory inputs. So it is a little bit like, and I think I spoke about before, proprioceptive. So you prime the sensory system, then you introduce a bit more exposure to another one, and you build up the person's tolerance for those things. So you're tweaking the little levels in that person. But putting them in a sensory room doesn't do that. It doesn't even provide them with the opportunity maybe to get the proprioceptive vestibular. You need like the suspended equipment, which is like the swings or the slot, you know, things that allow that movement, that suspension. So the reason, I think there's a lot of misconception out there as well about, you know, what's a sensory room, how do we fix this or solve this? We don't really know, but it's kind of saying, well, we have a system that needs to be fed and we're not feeding it the right things.
There are so many, like the amount of tools and gadgets and the swings, the balls, even just stuff you have at home that I'm looking at through different eyes. But if someone doesn't go down the route of having someone like you, like we were able to do, we noticed that, you know, swinging Kaelin in like a little hammock, like blanket, that he responded well to that. So now I know that that's good for him. But I wouldn't, and doesn't always want to do it, but I wouldn't necessarily know that if it weren't for you. And what suits one person, what regulates one person might not another, and also what we think of as a sensory room might serve some sensory issues but not others. Like yes, there are so many solutions out there, but how does one go about figuring out the ones that's best for them as a person or for their child?
I suppose I have my, you know, years studying in OT and another 5 years postgrad doing sensory integration and neuroanatomy and stuff, so it is complex. And then you take years of caseloads, like sometimes it's literally experience of going, I tried this with this type of child and this type of child did this, and this is a good one and that. But it's so individualized. Yeah, it is. But it's the same way, I suppose, let's look at it from exercise. You know, you can go and walk and you can do things, or you can go and do like a Pilates class or a yoga class, or have a gym instructor tell you what you need to do rather than just lifting weights if what you want to do is, I don't know, strengthen your core or whatever it is. So it is kind of targeting the correct things. You can generally not go too wrong with linear movement, quite regulating and calming, and proprioceptive, so heavy, steady lifting. And you could try those and see. Generally rotation, so if a child is spinning, it can be quite dysregulating for most children. But some children do benefit. And if it is, it needs to be done in a very prescribed, specific way. So therefore, you would look for some guidance. There's different schools of thought out there, whether someone needs to go like every week or whatever, or whether you need to incorporate it into your day. I think it's great to incorporate it into your day and be careful in like a school environments and stuff too, when you keep sending a child out for movement breaks. Unless you're doing something that's giving them a need, you may actually be dysregulating them. You may actually be kind of making it more challenging.
But how can someone intervene with that if like the lunch break and the yard time is at the set time? Like, they obviously, systems have to be put in place, but like, will you just have to accept that your kid do you have to say, my kid doesn't want to go out that time, or we're not doing that?
It's not even at lunch. It's more like a child would be like, and usually I suppose an OT or a therapist or someone would have suggested, or a psychologist or someone might say, okay, this child needs more movement breaks. So it, you know, they need to have opportunities throughout the day. It might just be to stand up, shake your hands. We do it naturally. People go have a cup of coffee. They go to the photocopier. They do these things when their brain kind of goes into shutdown. So some people need movements to help them process as well, which again, movement is a vestibular, so it's a sensory seeking thing. And you're talking about school. Yeah, and some kids really struggle in yard. I've had lots of, and that would be a school I'd kind of come and say, could you do like a chess club? Could you do like a protected area in the space? Could you do, you know, and each school I might go into, I might look at different things and go, well, why don't we come up with this solution? Because it is hard, but equally, there are children who go out for yard and come back like starstruck. And then there's other kids that just need the yard because they're just like living for the yard, and they come back and they can focus and concentrate. So it's kind of finding the...
Yeah, because I'm worried about that element myself, because I know that he comes back in from being out in nature and he's regulated, but not if he's out in a yard full of screaming kids.
Focus on what we can change today, and that may not ever be an issue.
Yeah,
as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think this, like, yeah, it's like do the things that like strip it back sometimes, remove the screen time a little bit. Do more kind of baking and touching and muck and digging, even if it's just if you live in an apartment, like get a little bag of sand or like just bring it back to the kind of, and make it playful and motivational. Because as well, sometimes if we distract, and you may know that like with anxiety or whatever, like if we distract the mind a little bit, and the mind is engaged, then the tolerance for all the other stuff kind of dissipates. So it stops that rumination. It stops that kind of fixation. If you can get that motivation and meaning in and connection, it can kind of help too. So there's loads of different ways of pulling things out. But absolutely. And I think, as you said, even if it's not necessarily rooted in a sensory dysfunction, if you're stressed or anxious, you're going to experience more heightened sensory sensitivity.
I could keep you here for hours because this is such a dense topic. There's so many like layers and overlapping things. We, you know, you mentioned ADHD and autism and stuff. We don't have time to go there at all right now. But what would you like to leave people with? Like, do you think that there's people have misperceptions or if misunderstood, what do you think would be helpful as a key takeaway?
I think it's okay to advocate for yourself or your child and understand what it is you want or need and accept that that's the way you experience things. And it's okay, because don't battle with yourself. You're already battling with your senses. Figure out your key things that help you feel regulated and calm and safe, and factor them into your routine. So factor them into your day-to-day existence. And anyone out there who isn't affected by this but might have an opportunity to support people, look at your classroom environment. Do you have millions and millions and millions of papers on the wall? Do you have lots of, you know, noises? What way are your desk set up in a work environment? If it's an open plan office, do you have like visors? Do you have like different individual lighting? Is there like different kind of seats? Is there like, how can you, you know, do something nice for potentially other people that can reduce stress and anxiety for them? And I would think, if you can do it, why not? Because it feels good to help people.
I think one of the most important things as well to take away from this, and something that I hope will reassure people or help them take a breath, is that it's none of what you're talking about here, or there's not a single sensory issue that you need to fix rather than support. You know, it's not something you need to become more acceptable in society by tolerating really loud noises. You don't. You just need to find a way to support yourself in that environment, right?
Yes and no.
Okay.
Because it's the graded exposure piece.
Yeah.
It is the graded exposure piece. So you're building up your tolerance, like an allergy or whatever. You're building up your tolerance to that input, but you're also knowing when that's too much, and you're doing it slowly and softly, and you're not putting... It's like, I suppose, it's like the sun. Maybe I'm going to go on a random analogy. It might not work. It might be the analogy, like you're in the sun and you have to have factor 50 on initially or something. You know what I mean? Then not 50. Yeah. But your tolerance and what you need then when you go out, you know, okay, sun, scratch that.
Always wear your SPF.
That's 50, yes. But I'm just trying to use it as in something.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Something that you need to do on a
like
slow...
Like going for a run and going for 1 kilometer, yes, and going for 2 kilometers. Yeah.
But it's not that you don't go for a run, and you might never be in the Olympics or like, you know, doing marathons, but you still increase you maximize your ability to do those things.
Yeah.
Well, but nobody's broken. It's all like, as we go through life, we evolve, we like, and it's good for us to learn new skills and continue to improve in different areas. It's actually good for us, so we do it in a way that isn't causing us harm. And I think I don't know, there's probably loads of people out there who I know will say, I just don't do it, I don't put myself in that situation, I just don't. And there's pros and cons to that. Do you know what I mean? Like, at some stage, I've kids, and we are going to go to Disneyland. I have been putting it off as much as possible because it feels very overwhelming, and I don't want to have a meltdown in front of my kids, you know. And it is different things like that. But I know that it's, you know, fear of missing out and not wanting to let my disabilities or whatever hold me back from allowing my kids to experience things that they might really love.
Would you describe it as a disability?
Well, I also have dyslexia, but I'm neurodiverse, so it's a component. I see it as a component of how I am. I see it as a disability mainly because of how society is set up, that it causes me to have barriers. But if the barriers aren't there, I don't see it as a disability.
I get you.
If that makes any sense.
No, it 100% does. It's oftentimes it's the world we live in that's not supportive, as opposed to us that needs to be reshaped.
Talk about like the shape sorter, and then like I love this analogy, but it's basically like most people, yeah, are squares and they can pop in quite, fine, or circles, and that goes in. I'm a triangle. If you shove me into a circle opening, if I get in, I'm going to be a fragile interpretation of a circle, and that's not good for me. Mm-hmm. Or, but if you wait and go, actually, let's make a triangle shape, boom, in I go, I'm happy, I'm fixed, And I think that's, at the moment, if you're a triangle trying to be a circle, it's a disability. But if you have an opening of a triangle, no, it's not.
That's so true. You wrote a book also. Where can people find that, and who is it for? Why would someone benefit from reading it?
I just got to the stage professionally where, and I kept getting asked to like talk about my lived experience about being neurodiverse, and again, like how did you get through life with the sensory, with the dyslexia, dyspraxia, all of those things. The book, no, I dictated. I'm severely, severely dyslexic. So I have like a reading age of a 7-year-old. And I have, I can't write. So it was kind of a non-typical way of writing the book, I suppose. And feedback has just been really supportive for other people out there, parents and young people, or people who may be undiagnosed with some of these conditions too. A lot of people really relate to it. A lot of autistic people have got in touch saying, oh my God, I really relate to your book. Thank you for writing it. As well as, like a multitude of people. And it just gives a real, I am very blunt. I am very direct. And it just gives a real straightforward, a coming of age kind of book, and the challenges. And it also highlights all the different barriers in society that I physically had to encounter through trying to get an education, through trying to get employment, to all of these different steps, and how it's a book about resilience too. And it's kind of it's just there. People take from it what they need. It wasn't easy. I wasn't sure about putting it out, because I suppose we never want to,
it's vulnerable,
to be that exposed. It's very vulnerable. It's very vulnerable. I can't take it back now, like thousands have read it, but it seems to be helping.
I mean, to be able to go through something like that and then not just write about it and share it to help other people, but like you've made it your whole career in helping other people understand and appreciate and accept who they are, how they are, how their kids are. And you're single-handedly creating more triangles in the world for us to fit into.
But it is available in the audiobook, I forgot to say, because I made sure it would be available for people who might struggle to read. Or it's also available in print in lots of bookshops and on Amazon.
And the title?
It's called Knowing No Boundaries.
Knowing No Boundaries. Love it. Hannah Daly, thank you so much for your time. I hope that you have enjoyed it. I haven't overwhelmed you too much with all my questions, but I think it'll be really good for people to, I suppose, validate something that's not spoken about a huge amount. And I do think like there is definitely an issue of people thinking someone's just fussy or selfish, or needing to have their boxes ticked, when really it is something that causes great anxiety in people. But also
cause pain. Like I would have said it's like a physical pain.
And that there are lots of supports out there. Like apart from your book, like where would you want to direct people who maybe want to know more about whether they have sensory issues or their kid does?
The Sensory Integration Network have great, they do great online courses and stuff too.
Okay.
And for teachers, parents, and the Sensory Integration Network is like, it's a good source.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for your time. And thanks so much. Absolutely.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
The easiest way to access Owning It Real Time is to head to the link in the episode description or episode details, whatever you call them, show notes. You will find the link in there at the top. You can sign up right away for Owning It Real Time and access the full library of 10 situation-specific audio guides that will help you own your anxiety even more than you've ever done before.